Hey, welcome back to this episode of Linguistics with Laura. I hope you've been thinking about linguistics since my last episode, because I know I sure have, but that's nothing new. Some people might even say that's all I think about because it's all I talk about. Speaking of thinking, today's episode is going to focus on a fascinating question that has plagued linguists for centuries. That question is, does language influence how we think, or does how we think influence our language? Well, in short, the answer to this question is yes. Both of these are true. But there's much more to these broad questions that we're going to dive into in today's episode. An American linguist by the name of Benjamin Lee Whorf focused much of his career on this question and came to the conclusion that language determines the way we think. He claimed that if a language has no word for a certain concept, then its speakers would not be able to understand this concept. Many came to see this belief in linguistic relativity as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, first coming to light under linguistic anthropologist Edward Sapir in 1929, and later studied by Whorf. Though this idea that thought is relative to language is known as the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, Sapir and Whorf never actually worked together to create this idea. Instead, Sapir kind of got the ball rolling with this idea, and Whorf picked up where he left off and made this line of thought more popular among linguists at the time. While you may think that Whorf's claims are a bit insensitive, saying that people of different languages think fundamentally differently just because of their language, Whorf was actually still pretty woke with this thought process for the time period he was living in. Instead of viewing people of different regions and languages as biologically and inherently different from one another, Whorf theorized that there may be an external factor distinguishing people from each other in this way. However, that being said, I, as well as many linguists, would take issue with this overarching claim that without language there could be no thought. There's a bit of a hole in this logic, if you ask me. By saying that you can't think of something that your language does not allow you to understand, how would you learn new concepts? Have you ever been trying to explain a certain feeling you had but just couldn't quite put it into words? Or maybe you're looking for a word to describe something but just can't seem to find the right one, no matter how many times you Google synonyms for a word that's similar to what you're thinking of. In Mandarin Chinese, the form of a verb doesn't change, regardless of whether it is in the past or present tense, yet speakers of the language are still able to tell and understand the difference between past and present. To me, these examples are pretty solid logical evidence that language is not the be-all, end-all for our thoughts. However, the debate is nowhere near over. Believe it or not, there's actually a pretty big piece missing from this supposed tug of war between language and thought. That piece would be culture. As it turns out from years of linguistic research and studies occurring after the creation of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis, instead of looking at the influence of language on thought or vice versa, the issue is best illustrated through a triangle in which language, thought, and culture are all at play here. Have you ever heard someone say that the Inuit communities have hundreds of words for snow? Well, this is a perfect example of cultural influence on language. The idea was first brought about by anthropologist Franz Boas when he traveled to Canada in the 1880s. However, this legend has been exaggerated and cliched over the years, with many linguists arguing that this claim is nothing more than a big hoax. But turns out the dismissers spoke a little bit too soon. According to an article I read on pangeanic.com, Norwegian linguist Ole Henrik Maga, and I'm going to be honest, I do not know if I'm pronouncing that correctly, claimed that the Sami people living in the northern tips of Scandinavia and Russia have 180 words for snow and ice. Apparently, they also have nearly 100 words for reindeer. Experts say that the reason some cultures have many words for one thing is due to the fact that language evolves to focus on the most important aspects of life. One reason this debate has gone on for decades is due to the fact that some languages, like Mandarin Chinese, are what are called analytic languages, while languages like those spoken by the Inuit are referred to as synthetic languages. When meaning and syntactic relationships are primarily determined by a word order rather than the addition of morphemes, we have an analytic language. On the flip side, a synthetic language, like those of the Inuit, makes use of several morphemes to establish meaning and syntactic relations. Okay, so that was a lot of technical jargon, but basically what the main difference is comes down to sentences full of many smaller, simpler words versus sentences with fewer words but still words that are large and complex. Though English is a mixed system and uses both synthetic and analytic strategies, it's more analytic than synthetic. So because the Inuit use synthetic strategies, speakers can load a very large amount of grammatical information into one big monster word. People who dismissed Bose's claim argued that two terms using the same base with a different inflectional ending don't really count as two different words, which I agree with. However, according to another article I read in the Washington Post, anthropologist Igor Krupnik concluded that Bose took this into account and didn't include words with different inflectional morphemes as two separate words. Yet, he still found that the Inuit have many more words for snow than English. That being said, there's still some disagreement among linguists as to how accurate these claims are, and something tells me it isn't the type of issue that can be easily resolved because, well, after all, language is one of the most complex components of being human. Nevertheless, whatever you find yourself believing, you can't deny that the famous legend that the Inuit have hundreds of words for snow presents an intriguing case for how language is affected by culture. But the triangular influences of language, thought, and culture still don't end there. If you've studied a language other than English, you may have noticed how nouns are gendered in some languages. In many ways, this attribution of gender to nouns is pretty arbitrary. For example, the word for dress in Spanish is masculine, el vestido, while the word for beard is feminine, la barba. However, to many speakers of the language, gender is more than just an arbitrary distinction of nouns. Take the word bridge. In Spanish, this word is masculine, el puente. In German, though, this word is feminine, die Brücke. Because the word in Spanish is masculine, Spanish speakers think of a bridge as strong and sturdy, much like the way humans view the male gender. German speakers, on the other hand, view bridges as beautiful and elegant, much like the way we view the female gender. Another example of linguistic influence appears in something that, for many of us, seems an irrefutable black and white or green and blue fact of science. I'll explain. To English speakers and speakers of many other languages as well, the colors green and blue are completely different, separate colors. You're probably even really confused because I'm insinuating that this isn't necessarily the case. I know I was certainly mind blown when I heard this for the first time, but believe it or not, in some languages like Korean and Vietnamese, green and blue are considered shades of the same color. And further, it appears that the colors we see as different refine our visual sensitivity to certain color differences in reality, so our brains are trained to exaggerate the distance between shades of color if these have different names in our language. Funny enough, I was just having a conversation with a friend of mine where we were talking about color and wavelength and how different shades of the same color, or what we English speakers see as the same color, are just as different in their scientific wavelengths as red and orange, for example. This fact really rocked my world because, at least to me, color seemed much more of a scientific and exact science rather than something that's influenced by my language. But it doesn't end there. Though rare, there are a few languages out there that don't have something we see as an essential component, not only to language, but just basic math. These languages are what's called anumeric, meaning they don't have specific words for specific numbers. So if you asked them how many fish they caught that day, they couldn't respond with something like 13, but instead they might respond with something like a few. Seems pretty difficult to live without specific names for numbers, but speakers of these languages live very well adapted to their environments and have for centuries, according to an article I read published under the Conversations website. Now, if someone were to say to you, "Oh, check the cabinet slightly to the north," you might be pretty confused upon hearing this. English speakers are used to what's called egocentric coordinates, or more commonly known as left and right. These terms, left and right, have no absolute meaning, but rather are completely relative to where a person is located. If you and I are facing the same way, then we have the same left and right, but if we're facing the opposite way, our left and right is switched around. In many languages, there's no such thing as left and right. Instead, speakers use the geographical coordinates north, east, south, and west to describe the location of objects and places that surround them. So for them, it's actually the norm to say something that would translate in English to, "Oh, not that cabinet, but the one to the west." Because of this, speakers of these types of languages have a much stronger sense of geographical orientation than us English speakers. If I asked you right now which cardinal direction your left was pointing, my guess is that you would really have to stop and think for a moment to answer my question. That's because in English, we don't have a super practical need to be geographically oriented, thus we're not accustomed to knowing which direction we're facing. Speakers of the language Gugu Yimithir of North Queensland, for example, would be able to tell you instantaneously where the north, south, east, and west are. Speakers of this language learn to orient themselves at a young age, and because they get so used to knowing which direction they're facing, you could literally bring them into a dark cave, spin them around 10 times, and though they would probably feel pretty dizzy, they'd most likely still be able to tell you where the north, south, east, and west are. My last example for demonstrating the fascinating link between language, thought, and culture comes from a simple gesture, the head nod. If you're from the United States and speak English, you're probably familiar with this common gesture that signifies a simple yes. To think that a head nod would mean anything other than an affirmation would seem weird and hard to wrap your head around. Well, you guessed it. In some countries like Greece, Iran, Turkey, and Bulgaria, nodding your head up and down actually means no, the opposite of what you're probably used to it meaning. And furthermore, in those same countries, shaking your head side to side actually means yes, thus making these two gestures signify opposite things from what many others are used to. This fact just proves furthermore one of Hockett's fundamental design features of language, arbitrariness, which states that language is made up of arbitrary and iconic symbols that have no intrinsic correlation to the thing that they signify. But we'll talk more about meanings and sounds when we get to semantics and phonetics. If you're interested in learning more about the ways in which language, thought, and culture all intersect, you can find lots of information via articles written by well-trusted sources with a simple Google search, language, thought, and culture. So, at the end of the day, Benjamin Whorf wasn't dead wrong in saying that language affects thought. He just took it too far. Instead of saying that language influences thought and vice versa, he claimed that language determines thought, and without it, we couldn't think. The fact is, however, that our thoughts have led us to creating words that adequately explain certain feelings and concepts and emotions and objects, and the list goes on. However, the way we perceive our surroundings is clearly affected by the means we have for making sense of everything, language, which makes sense. In the end, after years of studying the relationships between language, thought, and culture, linguists, anthropologists, and the like have concluded that, in fact, language, thought, and culture all influence each other. Thanks for listening today, and be sure to tune in next time. We're going to dive right into the linguistic topic of syntax, or the rules and principles that govern sentence structure, so make sure you're ready to get your grammar on. I'll see you next time.